Cordial Rigdon, all good Samantabhadra, great Vajradhara, lotus born Pat, Dawa Songpo, the other Dharma Rajas, and the 25 Rigdons who guide beings to the sacred land of Shambhala. You are the sun and moon, the wish fulfilling jewel. Your brilliant mind is the ornament of the world. Protect my Vajra awareness. Grant your blessing so that I may realize great bliss wisdom. Gesar Norbu Drottel, you are the great activity lion. All victorious Sakyong, you reveal the treasure of basic goodness and radiate the great eastern sun. Ashe, the essence of life, fearlessly reveals confidence and compassion. May all discover the power of this magic. The Drala lineage of Mukpo, you bring about the new golden age. Grant your blessings so that I may liberate all beings. Buddhas, Bodhisattvas, warriors, masters of the three times, you guide us along the path to liberation. You awaken Bodhicitta. You teach us the great view of emptiness. You reveal the joy of luminosity. Transmitting awareness, wisdom, you lead us to perfect enlightenment. Grant your blessings so that I may realize my nature is the profound, brilliant Rigdon.
Good evening, Rinpoche. It makes the Atlanta Sangha's heart sing to hear the Shambhala lineage chant resound in this room with you here. Welcome, everyone. Nice evening, isn't it? I'd like to introduce Sakyong Mipam Rinpoche to you.
We can't hear.
Like this. Sorry. I'd like to introduce Sakyong Mipam Rinpoche. He is the lineage holder of Shambhala Buddhist lineage, the son of the Vidyadhara, Shogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. He's been also recognized as an incarnation of Mipham the Great, who is an emanation of the Buddha of wisdom, Manjushri. And I would like to say, Rinpoche, that we are so inspired by your wisdom and the way you bring practicality and the wisdom of our ancient tradition together and how we might benefit society. We appreciate your support of this Sangha and in being here and blessing us with your teachings. I am always so amazed to think of your life and I think one of the things that kind of engenders that for me is the fact that you spent your early years in India and then came to the U.S. to live with your father and received many great teachings and then went back to Tibet to teach those teachings to the incarnation of your father. That's beyond comprehension for most of us. So that's kind of my koan. So we're inspired by your efforts to bring wisdom and compassion to this world, noting your recent efforts in the financial crisis, addressing the leaders of Goldman Sachs, telling them that leading with compassion would actually be of great benefit and perhaps even make them more money. And the wonderful teachings you've been doing with Queen Noor, the Queen Noor of Jordan, in addressing very elite and broad audiences and how we might bring peace instead of cultivating fear in this world. How we don't have to give in to fear. And I think my personal inspiration from you is how you're willing to share your life with all of us and share everything that you have with all of us. So I ask you to weave all these threads together. Please teach us, sir.
Okay. So thank you. How are you? Good? That's a good start. So I'm as delighted and maybe even more delighted to be here than to be received by some of you, because it was a few years ago that I came here and there was a dream and a wish to turn a small part of Atlanta into a little jewel, into a little garden that could be an environment where we could practice meditation, where we could all develop peace, where we could strengthen our minds, and how in the center of busyness we could just be silent. And silence our fear and hesitation, and discover our basic goodness. So, as you can see, it was not a small dream, but quite a challenging dream, especially when it was mostly a parking lot. and what's going on here. But it's really heartwarming for myself, and I think in the introduction you were introduced to myself continuing wisdom at a culture that was quickly and diminishing. And those of you who know a little bit about Tibetan history, you know, in 1959 the communists invaded and sort of ended, which was roughly 1,500 years of fairly undisturbed meditation. And came to a dramatic end and a very sobering end. But if you just think about it, you know, here we are, and this center is just a few years old. And if you can imagine 1,600 years from now, we're still here meditating, and we've been cultivating generation to generation. Themes like that as you're a child, that you have basic goodness. You know, we say, you know, everyone should be raised in the cradle of loving kindness. Taught kindness, that these soft themes that we think in the modern term soft are actually the most tough, strong themes. That if we are taught compassion, if we are taught courage, that actually make us resilient individuals. So I just came from India, and we spent 4 months there doing a series of teachings and meditations. And I was just really struck, because I knew I was coming here and I'm going to be teaching throughout the summer, that how we're still at this phase where this wisdom is pouring out of Tibet. It's in India now, and it's obviously coming west. And in fact, you know, this wisdom is probably, the hope is more in the west right now. I see, for example, I know that there's a recurrence in China, but a lot of that, and also in Tibet, there's a hunger for materialism because the country has been poor. So, you know, they want to make money and so forth. I remember going to Tibet a few years ago, and I was received by horses. As you know, people receive me here, traditionally you receive a teacher by lining horses, and you have a smoke ceremony, and it shows their enthusiasm. So it was hundreds of horses, and it was like a scene out of some Lord of the Rings sort of movie, you know, just sort of arriving, and then you fly in, and all of a sudden there's a lot of horses. And then you enter the monastery, which makes camping look like an upgrade, you know. there's no electricity whatsoever, and the animals are nearby and everything. So it's really 12th century. And then I went a few years later, and instead of horses, half of them were motorcycles. You know, so monks on motorcycles. And, you know, and the thing is that I was a little bit, you know, disappointed because part of me is Western. I thought I kind of liked the image of horses better. Themselves trying to modernize were very proud. You know, like they've made it. They got their motorcycle. You know, it took three horses to get one motorcycle. So they were quite proud of the fact. And also at the same time, you know, I went back to another place and I was giving a ceremony. And we were doing something which was supposed to be silent, and then in front of me, a cell phone goes off. You know, this is at 16,000 feet, right? And there's no running water. There's a cell phone that goes off. So it was like very profound meditation, and there we, you know, we had a big elaboration, and there's a monk in front, and he pulls out the cell phone. So I'm sitting on like a throne like this, and I look down. He looks up, and he can tell that I'm displeased. So he's got the phone like this, and he goes. Which if for those of you who don't know, it's half of this. So what I was hoping for was down and then maybe this. But this was a compromise. So I realized, here we go, we're living in compromise already. So it was interesting keeping, you know, the need for human beings and progress, success, at the same time not losing some kind of purity and integrity. And I think what produced people like my father and what produced people like Pema Rinpoche and His Holiness the Dalai Lama is this kind of ability to cry. And laugh. And we were in this kind of it's okay. We were in this kind of period where this level of, I don't know how else to say it, but in a profound understanding and heart that is preserved. And I don't want to go on about this, but I think that something was preserved a long time and now we have it and you have access to it. And this is what we're trying to do here. And I feel like we're in that generation. I certainly feel the pressure myself of holding many, many kinds of wisdom that has been practiced for generations. And I feel like we're at a time where we're entering into more of a materialistic culture. And what I mean by that is I don't want to say anything negative about materialism as such, because we need a house, you know, we need a car to get from A to B. It's not that. But I think it's a matter of priorities. It's that somehow, you know, what happened in the Tibetan culture is that they put a tremendous emphasis on the development of the heart and the mind. And, you know, as, you know, one of the really good quotes by the Dalai Lama is that, you know, and I think he says this to Tibetans more than he does to Westerners. And he says, you know, the Westerners have a little edge over us, meaning the Tibetans, when it comes to the material things. But we've got a head start on the mental stuff. And so there's that notion that it's been cultivated a lot. And I know that this development of meditation in the mind and the heart existed certainly even in the ancient world, even within different traditions, within Christianity, within different philosophies. And it has been practiced by Buddhists, and it has been inspired all throughout the world. And I don't think it's just an Asian thing. I feel like it is a universal principle. And certainly that's what Shambhala, the historical or the mythical kingdom of Shambhala, our namesake, is based on. that it's a society where people live together and there is a mutual appreciation for the material and for the spiritual, for the mind. And I feel like that is sort of what we are trying to do here, is balance that. And what I've noticed is that you can actually have the greatest and best teachers, but it is really us who are going to have to initiate it and put it into practice. And what I feel now is that this is the time where we're taking themes like compassion, we're taking themes like peace, and we're having to demonstrate it ourselves. And I feel like these principles are, first, we have to embody it, and we have to be able to have the confidence to be able to do it. And that's what part of, I feel like, in creating an environment like this is, having a center, having a building to support it. Because as human beings, we can say we are susceptible to our environment, and that can be in a positive or a negative. If we are not encouraged, like for example in Tibet, it was an environment where that was encouraged. If you were meditating, your mother and father would be happy, you know? If you went and did things, practiced generosity, people were happy. People realized it was a virtue. And I think here, when we are meditating and practicing, people are either think it's maybe a little bizarre, you know, it's unusual. And even, you know, obviously in different parts of the world, it's more common than others, but it's still unknown. And what I consider meditation is that it is just as we put energy into the material, it is putting energy into the spiritual or the mental or the heart. And it is not a religion as such, but it is the emphasis that we all have minds and hearts, and that realistically, when we experience life subjectively. We experience it through our own mind. When we're happy, it is our mind that's happy. You know, if we're driving a car and we're happy, our car is not happy. You know, we are happy in our car. Next day, we are depressed in our car. So it is really, you know, and what we do is we put emphasis on the material. So there has to be a period where we are putting emphasis on the consciousness. That's what the practice of meditation is. It's actually taking time to develop that. And what I always encourage people to do is that if you're unhappy and you're busy and you have more and more stress, in this culture, somehow we have to relieve that externally somehow. So obviously, you know, I'm a big believer in exercise. That certainly helps. But really what we still have to do is still kind of beating around the bush. We're not really addressing the main issue, which is the mind and the heart. So I feel like if there's a wisdom that's been transferred is that there is actually a tremendous teaching, technology, techniques, however you want to think about it, that is dealing with the mind and heart. Given that the mind and heart is different than the body and the material as such, that it's very hard to see what is happening. So what we have to be able to do is understand the process of why meditation is important, why it is important to take care of our heart and mind. And I believe that as we enter into this kind of next period of time, there is going to be further and further stress put on the mind and put on the heart. Why? Because, you know, there's an old logic, you know, in the meditative tradition, and it says that, you know, desire begets desire. Speed begets speed. Planning begets planning. A lot of times we think, if I can only plan well, then everything would be fine. But it only leads to more planning. You know? If we sit here, and, you know, I always think of meditation is that non-planning time. Just for a moment, don't plan. And if you think about what we're doing, we are up constantly, first thing in the morning, planning. It is instigating. That energy of planning and thinking and worrying doesn't just disappear. It gets absorbed. It gets absorbed in the environment. So if it's anger, it gets absorbed in the environment of anger. And conversely, if it is love or understanding, it gets absorbed too. So here we're moving into territory where some people might think, well, where's the proof? You know? Well, part of the proof is actually we're us having to practice and meditate and relate to our mind. But at the same time, these days, there's a lot of tests going on to meditation. I think, you know, we had one test last year at Shambhala Mountain Center, our center in Colorado, where we had 3 months of, it was one of the most full studies that were done. It was partly by Stanford University. And looking at the effects of meditation, which is essentially people developing their mind. And, you know, this kind of technique, this kind of analysis is a little demoralizing for the meditator because they have, you know, electrons coming out of their heads as they're trying to look cool, you know. But, you know, what they've noticed is, oh, yeah, when you focus on the mind and heart, things begin to change. You know, at a very basic level, the brain begins to function differently. Their nervous system begins to function differently. The heart begins to function differently. Things that have been taking on stress. So this is tangible things. So like in Tibet, I always say in Tibet, people think here, if you do meditation or something, it's New Age. I say, we didn't have New Age in Tibet, you know? You'd be kicked out if you were New Age. It was just the old age. And in Tibet, the proof of the pudding, you know, whether meditation worked or didn't work, is whether you froze in your meditation cave or you didn't. But so you have people who meditate on heat, and they're able to develop heat in their body so they can, you know, stay in sub-zero conditions. So it's a place, when I went there, I said, oh, interesting, you know, Tibet is a very real place. Only real stuff stays. Here, we live in a culture where we can do a lot of unreal things, and we don't really get much of a kickback. We can actually live in denial for a long time, thinking we're doing something. But when you want water in Tibet, you have to go and get it. You know, even if you want to go poop, you have to go and go to the edge of the cliff. So you can't casually wander into the bathroom saying, oh, maybe I'll brush my teeth, maybe I'll do this, maybe I'll do that. You really have to think about it. So it is this kind of culture that says meditation works. So, there's a different kind of proof now that's happening. And I think what has to happen in this generation is that we have to prove to ourselves this works. Not just scientifically, and also, you know, a lot of us can see people like the Dalai Lama, and for those of you who met my father, like my father, you can see, oh, it's a real deal. So they're seeing this hearing, but we have to prove to ourselves that it works, and we have to do it. Otherwise, we actually won't engage. So I feel like we're at a particular point in time where we have to prove now to ourselves individually and societally that these themes that maybe have been considered alternate themes, such as a strong mind, such as compassion, such as generosity, have to become mainstream themes. If this world is going to be better, basically. And if we keep on the material level and consume and consume, there is no doubt that we will be more and more unhappy. You know, I think it's just a very simple logic to the whole thing. So I also think that, you know, I believe in karma. And karma is a Sanskrit word that means action. In Tibetan, we say tendril or interdependence. You know, the classic analogy of interdependence is that in order for a plant, like an apple or an orange, to grow, it takes sunlight, it takes different soil conditions, many things have to come together. that everything is interdependent. The food that we eat is interdependent. It came from many, many situations. Life is interdependent. And when we begin to realize that the interdependency of life altogether here, we begin to wonder what kind of interdependent are we creating for peace and for betterment. So they say some karma is already established. For example, if you said something really nasty to somebody, somewhere down the pipeline, someone's going to say something nasty to you. This is sort of an inevitable kind of situation. There's certain karma that we're born into, and like we just have certain parents, we live in a certain town, and so forth. But they say a third of the karma or interdependence is unresolved, meaning that we're now sitting at that crux. So the future is not a foregone conclusion. It's looking a certain way, because if you look at it environmentally, we've polluted the earth a certain amount. Psychologically, we've taken a certain attitude of aggression and created more or less a kind of egocentric culture. So we're at a point where we have to decide how we're going to shift the future. And I know my feeling is that this is the time where we have to put forth kind of an alternate game plan, as it were. And this is totally based on the fact that we don't all have to become like perfect people. We all have faults. The Buddha, Shakyamuni, said, in this time there will be nobody without faults. Everyone will have certain faults. And what we have the choice essentially to go around and always look at people's faults. And they say, like is like. If your mind is obsessed with faults, then you begin to exude those faults too. So we have a choice, then we can switch and increase the positive. And it really is that kind of attitudinal switch that we have to do. We have to direct our mind that way. And what the point of the meditation is that even as simple as we are, developing our own mind and heart, even for 10, 15, 20 minutes, accumulatively, when you have millions of people, it begins to create an environment. You know, we're creating our own reality, as it were. And if aggression is more and more accepted, then the aggression will just increase. There'll be different levels of aggression. Previous levels of aggression will seem fairly mild, because it just keeps getting more and more sophisticated. So, you know, within the meditation tradition, we have different levels of sophisticated compassion. There's kind of raw compassion in the beginning. But then we get to the level of compassion where it's not just compassion for those that we are familiar with, but it's people that we don't even know. We develop ability to have compassion for those people who have a tremendous amount of animosity towards us. It increases. And this is just due to the fact that you can increase the ability and potential of the mind that much. So when I'm talking about developing our soft element here, this place that we've created is not kind of a simply sort of to a free zone where we get out of the hassle of the day. But a place like this is really to train and to develop. And one of the things that I always encourage when I'm teaching meditation is that a lot of times, because meditation, the word, most people hear, and I think, you know, rightly so, the first level that the modern kind of mind wants to do is relieve stress. So I would say the first benefit to meditation is an immediate stress reduction. But as soon as your mind has a level of relaxation and strength and stress reduction and strength, then you have to enhance the qualities. So meditation is twofold. One is the lessening of, we say, negative faults or kind of irritations and so forth, and then the increasing. So we're in a point of increasing. And what we have to do is when we get up in the morning, our mind is already, it's like a sponge, it's like a child. it's even the brain, what do they say, is 80% water. So it's absorbing continuously. And so we have kind of a hard exterior, you know, we have bone and skin. But really the mind is incredibly sensitive. It's very, very porous in that way. And it has to be related to. So that's what the meditative tradition is saying, that it has to be related to that particular way. And I think one of the key things in the beginning is that it's very important to understand how the meditation practice works, how you do it, and what I consider a successful meditation practice is the one that you continue your whole life. Anybody can force themselves to sit still for an hour, maybe, if we have to. But to have it day in and day out. So another point I would just like to emphasize is equanimity. Meditation creates that ability to be have that level of equanimity. A lot of people have come to me during this financial crisis. I was in India during most of the worst part. And you would hear all these amazing things, and there was a high level of stress, incredible depression to, incredible hope. And I was very proud of some of our practitioners, meditators, because they're able to remain with a level of equanimity. It doesn't help to get the highs and lows. It doesn't mean if we have equanimity, it doesn't mean we're a boring person. But we're able to sustain. And I think the practice of meditation or some relationship to it is going to provide the level to be, have the level of equanimity. Now, can we do this just on our own strength? It's difficult. In Tibetan, we have a word and it's called Rang Sanje. Rang Sanje. Rang means self, Sanje means Buddha. In Sanskrit, it's called Pratyeka Buddha, and we call it individual or solitary realizer. This is a kind of individual who, just by the power of their own will force, can stay on the path. But we say that person coming about is always a very rare occurrence. We all are interdependent, and we need a support system. So, for example, if you take one meditation class here and you go home and do it, the chances of failure are quite high. Because the notion of this practice being a lifelong practice, we are confused by. When we don't get short-term results, we think the practice is not working. But we're having to understand that this is actually a different approach to life altogether and the development. So I feel like, again, this is a notion of a cultural understanding. Also, I can be practical too. And, if you've got a tough week coming up, will meditation help? Sure, it'll help. So you can do kind of spot meditation, before some stressful situation. But the practice itself is something that I feel like, we need to understand and create the environment, and there needs to be an ability to support each other. So I'm a big fan of community support and individual support. And we need constant sort of companionship and checkup, encouraging each other. So the word meditation means, Tibetan we say komshi, and it means familiarity. So when we use the word to meditate, in English it has the word to contemplate, to think about, And in this word meditation, and especially in the Tibetan komshi or familiarity, the secret is in the word, because the word indicates once the mind is placed on something, it becomes familiar with it. So when we get up in the morning, we are automatically meditating. Our mind is familiar with something. So if we are thinking about negative things that we're worried about, it is meditating on becoming familiar with our worries. So the tradition of meditation is just taking advantage of that understanding of the mind and placing it on what is helpful. So what I would really encourage is that if you're meditating in your daily practice, that in the morning you automatically start having certain themes daily that you're increasing and developing your mind with. So it doesn't really matter how successful you're going to be. Because some people said, I meditated on compassion, didn't work. I still got mad. You know? I said, you know, it's not really the point in a sense. The point is that long-term development. And we have a few things working against us here, because first of all, our belief or understanding or proof in meditation is very weak in the beginning anyway, here in the West at least, because we think maybe it's weird. We're not sure if it works. And when it does, we immediately want kind of short-term results. So we have to reverse those and become, as the culture becomes more familiar and accustomed to it itself, our strength grows, we put more energy into it in our life. And then therefore that begins to exude in our own being. Is this boring for you? I can tell some more jokes if you want, but this is probably why you asked me to come here, to talk about this kind of stuff, right? But I do believe, and I feel encouraged that we can utilize this hall and these buildings, and we can help each other. And I see a tremendous change. And last fall, you know, my kind of, those of you who have read Ruling Your World, in that book, I encourage that. I say compassion is actually something that I feel like our leaders need. It's certainly something that was taught to myself. And so this notion of compassionate leadership, which, you know, 4 or 5 years ago seemed sort of like a pipe dream. When I talked about it, you know, when I sold this idea of my next book at that point to my publisher, and they loved the title of Ruling Your World. It sounded really kind of powerful. And they said, what's it about? I said, it's, you know, the whole book's based upon helping others. And they go, that's it? No one's going to buy that. But it's led to an interesting thing that when I did this speaking tour, we did it in NYU, New York University, and Tufts University, and then we had that one engagement at Goldman Sachs, and we arrived on the day before they had lost a lot of money. And then we arrived on the day that Warren Buffett had just put a tremendous amount of money into it. So it was a very bizarre situation for me to be in. And I was with Rabbi Kula, who's of the Jewish faith, and I was with Queen Noor of Jordan, and she's obviously from the Islamic tradition. So it was the three of us being there, and all of us, you know, agreed that the world needs to be more compassionate, and you need a compassionate system as opposed to self-centeredness. But it was pretty amazing thinking about it, and here we are in the main financial district in some of the worst time. And we had about 300 people. And it was a very international, there was Indians and there was obviously Americans, but it was a very mixed group. And we talked about that. We talked about compassion as a strong virtue. And that if we are compassionate, the notion of compassion is that we're considering others, therefore is intelligence. And by the fact that a leader or an individual can actually be compassionate means that they know what's happening with another person. And that when you have compassion for others, people work harder for you. There's a better environment. People are more productive, you know, in a very basic way. And I felt like my pitch had to be that this is not something you just do on Sunday, but you do on Monday. So, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, this wouldn't have flown well. But here we were, and because probably things were falling apart, they were at least listening. And many of them said, we'd love to have a course in this. You know? And so I feel like bit by bit, it's entering into the mainstream. And in that, it's beginning to affect our life. And I think it's important. Because we can't lose our heritage that way, that kind of meditative heritage. And I think some people were teetering on losing it. You know, they were hippies in the 60s and 70s. And love didn't work, so they went to business. You know? It's like, that's too bad. Now I'm back to the mainstream. But now the mainstream is saying, oh, actually, it's not working out for the mainstream either. So we're having to look at it. And that's why I see this is not the distinction of meditation as such being kind of categorized as spirituality or something is a very kind of tenuous definition in the first place. But certainly that's coming down. And I feel like what we're doing now is developing tools and skills to how to integrate it. And the first phase of that is actually learning and grafting what's already been successful in another culture. Like, for example, the Tibetan culture. But we're the generation that's going to have to figure out how to apply this. First, believe in it, and then apply it. Be successful. So if you're in business, if you're successful applying compassion and mindfulness and peace, then other people will want to do like-minded businesses. If we are in dealing with education, it's going to be the same thing. So it's very much, I feel like, how we do it, and it's not easy nut to crack. We have to apply ourselves. So anyway, I'm very happy to have all of you helping and coming tonight and just being here. I certainly encourage you to practice. And I would also encourage you to practice not too much, not too little. And you should get up in the morning and think about how lucky you are. And when you go to bed at night, just review your day, just saying, what did I do? Doesn't have to be heavy duty. What did I do? And what would I do differently? So there might be something, I was a little mean, I was a little this, I was that, I was happy I did that. And then have an attitude of what you would like to do the next day a little bit. So I think this kind of thinking, maybe 2 to 3 to 4 minutes at most, so it takes just a little bit of reflecting, You can even do it in the shower. If you're not meditating, you can do it in bed. But if we don't do something like this, then a whole life goes by, nothing changes. Or unseen karmic forces that we're not even aware of just pull us like a tide in the ocean. And then we end up in a very awkward position, and then we're just struggling to get out of it. And it may take years and months to get out of it before we're back to neutral. So it's very much, I think, just looking at it. And so some people tell me, it's like if I'm a priest, I meditated. And I think they want me to say, bless you. I say, well, of course, that's great. But it's not a matter of just putting in the hours. But it is a matter of intelligently putting in the hours or putting in the minutes. So if you'd like to ask some questions, I've been asked to do a blessing, and also there's a, we have rice. Yeah. Do a rice blessing from the place too. Actually, let's just, for a minute, let's just practice. Let's sit for a moment. So I think the main thing now is with the practice of meditation is mentally try to make the transition smooth. Don't get too uptight about that we're doing something extraordinary. We are just taking our posture. Legs are crossed. If we're sitting in a chair, sit comfortably. The posture is, the spine is has a natural curvature. The head is placed on the spine so it balances. The arms are comfortable. These are all creating the conditions for us being able to relate to our mind. And first, have just a sense of body awareness, so it is not so cerebral. So even this level of transition by thinking about something and then bringing your awareness back to the present, to the body, and now we begin to feel our breathing. As I mentioned before, meditation is familiarization. We're just becoming used to, accustomed to the breathing. Exhale. Inhale. This is a time for us to be very simple. We have all day having to be somebody, project these concerns and worries. It's giving our mind and heart a bit of a break. And naturally, the mind is very busy, so as it begins to relax, it's like a car that's been turned off. It has to slowly come to a halt. That's it. Even if our mind is just quiet and experiencing a level of calmness, just for a few moments, that's a few moments more. And as we do this, we learn contentment, being content and satisfied with our experience. And as we do that, it's a very healthy theme to develop instead of a mind that's always craving for more. Try to balance the technique, the approach, by not trying too hard and also not being too overly nonchalant. So if there are some questions, please feel free to ask. There's a microphone there.
Mm-hmm. I would like to know how you developed your beautiful writing style.
How do I what?
How you developed your beautiful writing style, your style of writing.
Well, thank you. Glad somebody thinks so. I treat writing for me it's like music, in that there's a flow, and when there's a bad note, I can feel it, and because you're trying to communicate something, and a lot of times the bad note is me. So if you get too involved in it, it begins to kind of ruin the whole thing. So there's a sort of connectivity, but also at the same time, a disassociation that I feel when I'm writing and communicating. And, you know, and then on the other hand, it's a practice. You know, it's continuing to do it. And I'm right now working on another book, so I got up today and did some writing. I find it very soothing and comforting. And it's interesting for myself because a lot of the themes that I try to communicate, I've learned myself from very terse and very, in the Tibetan at least, very kind of heavily, you know, I guess the word would be academic. You know, a lot of the texts are written in Tibetan, like in these, are meant for a general sale or publication. They're like from one teacher to another teacher. And there are a lot of lists and categories and things like that. So there's a quality of trying to bring life to it and try to communicate it. So we'll see how the next one goes. It's always a waiting game.
If anyone else has questions, we ask three people to come here. And as the next person leaves, then one more person can come up.
Thank you, Rinpoche, for your talk. It was very timely. And I have a kind of odd question, I presume. Recently, I've been thinking a lot about compassion. I read Words of My Perfect Teacher, and I've also been practicing a lot, and what I find is I almost feel schizophrenic, where if I've been practicing, I feel euphoric, but then when I go out, and it's not even my life, which is pretty okay right now, but it seems like I see a lot of really intense suffering, mm-hmm. and I get overwhelmed by that. I don't know how to approach that or how to deal with it.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think there's two kinds of compassion here. This one is just kind of being human and touching in with the, you know, endemic kind of suffering that's going on. So we're kind of shutting our eyes and we open our eyes to it, and we get a glimpse. And having got a glimpse, then the other kind of compassion is really a mind training. So it's just not feeling the pain, but it's beginning to actually train one's mind, to develop one's mind. And so one's mind becomes strong to be able to hold that emotion and that feeling. And I think that is more, there's a quality when you have compassion and you finally get the feeling of compassion, you stay in that moment where you, you know, if you use an image in your mind and then your heart opens or your mind opens, you say, oh yeah, there is suffering. As soon as you have that, your mind stays there and strengthens and develops, and that's the kind of the mind training. And you have to train your mind and strengthen your mind simultaneously as you're developing the ability to open up and have compassion. And I think that's a very critical element. It's the other element is, you know, with compassion, you have to have intelligence. You know, intelligence, sometimes we say that the last part of intelligence, you know, or the final aspect of intelligence is compassion. When you are very intelligent, finally you realize what is going on. And you need intelligence. It can't just be a raw emotion. So that we're defining emotion as something that destabilizes you. You know. So if there's something that overtakes you, then it's an emotion. It camouflages itself as compassion. So it's a compassionate guise. But then it kind of overcomes you. So you have to be very aware and aware of your mind and have a level of knowing what to cultivate and what not to cultivate in your meditation practice. But it is really a strengthening of the whole thing. It's, you know, part of that is developing your own shamatha practice. So that's staying with it and your mind, as I was saying, having a level of equanimity, so that you're not thrown off by when you have these insights.
Thank you.
Is that helpful?
Much.
Yeah, okay.
Hello. In these times of crisis, do you see opportunity on a particular field? Do you see some particular area that is more fertile to bring the teachings of Shambhala. For example, I'm thinking of the environmental area that is growing also because of the crisis with the oil. Do you see any particular areas that are more fertile for absorbing the teachings of Shambhala?
Right, I think this. Yeah, I think there's two things. One, I think it has to be. I think leadership is very important, but it's very hard to penetrate politically, because obviously politically it's to do with the political base. So people are very concerned about that. But business, I think, is an area that can be affected more now. I also feel like, of course, environmentally. But I feel like environmentally, there has to be a strategy, because you can kind of be aggressive environmental too, you know what I mean? So there has to be an approach of using that opportunity to see wholeness, interdependency between oneself and one's environment. And I think the opportunity in Shambhala here is to, there's an opening in the general public. You know, people intuitively know when something is good and when something's bad, and us to foster that. And I think if you foster that, then the business people and the politicians and those people who can make a difference begin to shift. So, you know, it's looking at all strata, really. It's from a very individual level and all the way through. Education is something that we would obviously like to have some contact with, but it's also very difficult because a lot of these systems are very stuck. I know the Dalai Lama has been trying very hard in the scientific world, but what happens is that, you know, in science, the best opportunity is, you know, right, people in graduate school. Because a lot of times once people are out of graduate school, their doctorate and so forth is based upon, it's being sponsored by various companies and things. So it's very hard to penetrate them because they're tied in with the money and everything. So even though they want to, they can only do it as a side thing. So it's looking at the points of where we can penetrate, and I feel like environment, definitely. I feel like that's something that is part of our culture, you know, part of what's happening. There's, but, you know, I, part of what I'm thinking about is I think we have to become leaders somehow. And I know for myself, people put a lot of pressure on me to do different things, but I really feel like actually, it has to be more than myself trying. It has to be many of us in those positions. And if you have leaders, and the effectiveness is that if you have one good leader, it begins to affect a lot of things. You know, and I think that leader needs to know that there's people who will support that. Did you have an idea?
No, I actually was... I was coming from the idea of this opening within the the environmental area. And, and if there are any particular teachings that can share a common frame of thinking that can be more directly applied into sustainability as part of what Shambhala is, sustainability into emotions and heart.
Yeah. I think that the connection with the environment is that as we begin, like just a simple correlation is as we meditate, we see the power of thought. So the power of thought we see effective on our own self. As we meditate, we're fine, and a thought comes up and pollutes the whole environment. So then we feel bad. And we have to realize that we have to gain control or understand where those thoughts are coming from, what the power of the thoughts are. Thoughts then lead to heavy emotion, it creates karma, it's a cycle. So that's just a meditative looking at it. But how that manifests is the individual is one thought. So if there's an individual that is mad, then they begin to pollute the environment. So we can see that the meditation is not an inactive process. We see how the ability for everyone to deal with their own garbage, as it were, mentally, begins to affect the environment. Because if they're not willing to do it mentally, they don't see the garbage around. They're just doing it because they're being punished or it's the law. So there has to be, that's what I'm talking about, there has to be some kind of societal awakening, you know, and I hate to use this phrase, but the conscious level has to rise. You know, my feeling is that human beings have survived because from a primitive point they worked together and it was their consciousness being a little higher that allowed them to run away and get away and do things. So here we are, we have to raise our consciousness if we're going to get out of this very kind of knee-jerk animal manifestation. And the planet will no longer sustain it at a certain point. We will kind of self-destruct. You know, we will, you know, there won't be any choice left. And so what happened is right now, and especially I think like in America and Europe, you know, we're beginning to feel it economically, but other places you can kind of see the whole thing falling apart. And here there's a buffer still. It's a bit of a dangerous buffer too, because we think everything's okay. You know, and if we don't see it on TV and hear it on the radio, everything's okay. But meanwhile, everything's happening. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. This is not very... This is going to get more depressing, huh?
good evening. I watched your video online, What About Me?
Uh-huh. Okay. Uh-huh.
I really enjoyed it. The part where you say, if you only do one simple thing and turn me for you.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like to know, how do you actually practice that in everyday life? Like, do you just have an intention there in no matter what you do, or is there something else?
Well, I think it's all those things. I think, first of all, having a practice where you generate compassion, and compassion being just thinking about others, just wishing people well. So when we say meditating with compassion, it doesn't mean just having a big bleeding heart emotion. Like, there may be times when we are so saddened, we may cry. But it is sitting there, and just our baseline is, may you be happy. And it can be, we start off with an individual, and then we move in terms of the whole world. And if you notice, in our mind, subconsciously, we are saying that mantra, me, 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 me. May I be happy, may I be happy. So as soon as you walk into a restaurant, may I get what I want. You know, and when I in a relationship, may I get what I want. You know, whatever it is. And so we're looking at that and saying, how happy has that made me? Should be pretty happy. But we're not. So that's the wisdom that we're talking about. It's switching. You know, and what it does is it loosens the grip. Generally what happens is the more we want to be happy, the smaller the possibilities that make me happy are. So it just tightens up to the point where everything has to be perfect. And then, you know, it's a perfect situation to be, you know, upset, basically. And so you begin to switch it. And it's really opening the mind. It's a technique for making the mind bigger. And what we say is that the mind is consciousness. And when we focus on ourselves, that consciousness becomes smaller and smaller and smaller. My mother, you know, says... I remember when she first came to America and I was giving a talk and she goes, tell them about big mind. And she's done a lot of retreats and meditation herself. And you know, she came to America and thought, oh, this is the most famous country in the world. Must be a lot of big minds. And it's just natural. And she came here and they said, why are people so, you know, there's so many things going on, but the more there is, the less to make us, unhappy. And then either we don't have it, and then somebody else has it, and we're jealous. So it's like, you know, we actually have it saying, when we see somebody even eating an ice cream cone, enjoying a good day, instead of being jealous, just the thought of like, oh, that's great, I'm glad to see somebody who's happy. That's the basic level they're at. And the thing is, it's so simple, we kind of ignore it. And what happens is that's what mind training is these different kinds of thought patterns begin to develop and strengthen. And then also you can make it specific, like today, you know, from 10 to 11, I'm going to really think about other people. Just give yourself an hour, you know. You may be 59, 56. Thank you. Yeah.
Rinpoche, first I'd just like to say thank you for all that you do bring to us and offer in the way of leadership. I wanted to ask, related to two questions back, does Shambhala, the larger organization, have a facility or a method that is facilitated to guide our political, financial, and business leaders? Should they be looking for specific advice? Is that something that does exist? Is that something that could exist in the larger idea of what Shambhala brings?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this time, I think it's been a wish for many people, and I think that I feel like it's a maturity and a development. I think a certain degree, some people felt like they had left the financial world and the world, and that's why they were here meditating. So there's a sense that they don't want to get re-involved and get their hands dirty. And I think there's been a natural kind of development where actually all spheres are completely fertile in terms of how to actually help and get involved. So I feel like that's happening now. I'm certainly encouraging it. I know that at times when my father was first teaching, he had a few different teachings, but I think really honestly people were too young and people hadn't quite, you know, it wasn't quite. And I think some people were mildly successful, but I feel like now is that time. And I also feel like the outside world is more, you know, ready and open. So I would like to. I'm encouraging different people to have programs, and I feel like these programs can be both people can be in the center, and also what I feel like doing is we should have certain programs that could be exported, that go into different businesses and different communities. That you work in their environment, you teach them how to practice and different kind of skills in that particular way. And I feel like that's inherent in the Shambhala tradition, because we're dealing with, you know, like the six ways of ruling and these different categories of actually how to manifest. And I feel like it's there. But I also feel like, and I mentioned this to the some of the senior students. A lot of people have gotten into meditation pretty much just for individual reasons. And they didn't necessarily, and maybe a lot of you, didn't necessarily come in here for a societal reason. But then when we begin to realize there's a relationship between society and the individual, then naturally that begins to, you know, the correlation is there. But I feel like it's happening now, and I feel like I would like to move it that way. And I also feel like this is a perfect place here in Atlanta to do that. And this center is perfect for that kind of training. And I'd like to have more of that leadership training here, if you'll have me back.
When?
Soon.
I'm told I'm supposed to kiss the microphone.
Okay.
So I hope I'm doing this right. I appreciate your coming to Atlanta. I am very selfish in my appreciation because that gives me a chance to have met you. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say that I have worked in the military. I was an Army nurse. And I've just retired after 20 years in the educational system at a university. Mm-hmm. And I see a lot of similarities between the military and the educational system.
Uh-huh.
I see some nods of heads,
uh-huh.
which I'm delighted. I really think this room holds a lot of sophisticated people. And I think that many ways you may be preaching to the choir. And the reason I say that is... I'm a nurse. I'm a psychologist, and I have worked very hard at practicing compassion throughout my life before I became Buddhist or before I joined this tradition. And I think there's a lot of people in this room who are like me. And the reason I'm here speaking or standing up speaking is because I'm really speaking to the audience. And the reason I am is because I, like you, Sakyong, Rinpoche, I really believe that we are the key to what is happening right now in the world, and that only if we, the people in this room, are willing to stand up and speak loud and clear, and I mean this in whatever settings we are in, hospitals, universities, prisons, VA hospitals, I don't know, wherever we are, I really believe that we in this room and also elsewhere, but we, I think, do have, we would not be here in this room listening to you speak if we didn't have a connection to your words, a connection to your books. And I think we have a lot to carry from what you have shared with us. And I think I'm echoing what you're saying, in that we have to speak up to change the momentum of what is occurring right now. And I know it's creating waves, and that's the hard thing for me. I've always been an instigator. I do create waves. People love me or they dislike me because I make them uncomfortable, because I don't sit back and just blind myself to what I see. And I think we have to do that. I'm sad to work in a university where freedom of speech is really questioned, where the people I work alongside of, the colleagues I work alongside of, are afraid to speak up when they see things that are unethical, or they see they're only yes people. They don't want to shake the system anymore. And I think we have to, not in a rebellious way so much as a, look, there is a different approach. There is a different way to create cooperation and communication, and it's not power down. It's not intimidation. It's, like you say, by being less selfish, by being more open and listening and more open to new ideas, mm-hmm. which I think your message really does bring to this society. It has been very me oriented, and it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, I think that I appreciate your comment, and I think that it's about speaking up, of course. And then I think at this point, really for us, it's about embodiment. You know, that we really have to, you know, manifest something. And I feel like that's sort of what is the meditative tradition, that it comes out, and therefore people become curious. And I think that, you know, we have to use our skill. We have to use our skill in terms of the right way of not corralling people, but really just being that beacon, and that's very important.
Thank you.
Thank you. So this is a chant I'd like to do. It only takes about 6 hours, if it's okay. it's a very short chant, and it's calling on. It's a chant that was written by my predecessor, the previous Mipham Rinpoche, and in Tibet. And it is asking for the all the blessings to arrive at this particular place. And it's also done is when something is opening and when it's new. And it's asking for the 8 auspicious conditions to arise. And those of you who are familiar with chanting will know that it's a meditation, and it's a meditation of intention. So you have a certain intention, and then you verbalize your intent. And as you do that, you begin to provoke and instigate that kind of activity. So I'll say this, and then the rice is going to be the blessing. Om nanze nanda ranje lanje be taji jogje shena jogba ye sanje jodan gendam babezo kunla jaza dada taji jodame jabo zanden dandrago jambe jeba kunda bala wa kunla goba jara dauba de lumba zara dauba dembe Samjin damje logon debe ba yezam zaba zara dauba de zazun debe taje balje wa deorajek ba jela jaza lo jamba june balden doje zin. Chere zewan gombo jambe ba zaye nyingbo debar nambar za namge nyingbo banje gondo zang. Uba doje pega nunche da nobo dawa raje nyima nye jazan lenam taje balje jo janju zamba jela jaza ro renjun doje taje zishin. Jidun bezo yon gomala nida dudun bezo meo me me dun jaze mongo gulu derin jindu ju jaje chudu jawa jijin jese go gizu ngo wadun daji ba tashi lamo jila jaza lo zamba jimbo dazu me me bo me dun dedun jaba jimbo Pachi pudan lawa nama zon Honam doze de la je kola dan Dishi la dan dunan dojen jimbe wa rade nanan Sosum zun sasum nizun gile in tashin Jikten jawa jila jasa la da jak ten de Raja wa gedan yi wan zimba Samten jun yu jun tashin Jo ma hori de jimba wa wangke Bodan to de don susu dobe ye je go Macha den den pe ma ranjen den Doje ni ma nyaman chanpa po Choko na wan tayin doje jo Jikten wan chik Pema jabo kudung nga wangja nansin zinan wangjin hiruka sangwa yishi binza warahi dejun dupen dhudun kwa majik dhudun jodun jawa jizun nga wangjin dujin pong. Nathanya pangin jun dupan kya doji kuya ka sumin ka kami su nga jodun kwa asa mabab kudung yana sajin nga jodun jodun doji chakpa jimbo dujin ni. Nam yingu dhudun jin doji chakpa jipo ya nansi dewa doji tun tayi jidra dhuwa raka dhudu jin gimpo jiwa jishi ya rabjim sakwa. Okay, so 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 go be so wa de so jo dong ro na wa do me de me mon de jo dong ro so jo jo na je be san je dong jo je san ba jo zo lo je ze nam ga da 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 ye sam jin tham je me ne nyang yin le me de be ma le Padu sala majagi anandande ande barje bajo je barugundu sundu jende jode dala jeje changwe la zo na jese jongwa yishendu be majagi padu dambara jesu zo dambara jo ne jatang da tang da ye be samje nam che la jo dang damang ngu dung padu sa om yen dharma yen dung tra bawa However, this is a very important thing. So, Dene dan den la judo, korwe se do, shone chan, ine se dan judo, choda nam do, sre te, duzaye, benzaye, so. Okay, so that's the. In Tibetan, it's known as Rubni. It's the consecration of the building and the place. So that's. It's the short version. I'll be honest. And we also have the blessing. So blessing is, again, kind of creating the auspicious circumstances. So at least in the... kind of Buddhist and Shambhala tradition, there's the idea that we can be trying really hard and maybe not having an appropriate meditation experience and so forth. So we call for blessing, and blessing is considered to be the kind of a factor that allows for unstuckness to occur. So we call on different teachers and blessings for that to occur. And today I'm going to be using the Vajra. This is a tantric symbol of, and it's essentially representing indestructibility and the indestructible nature of our own mind. So it's representing our mind, which is indestructible. And when it's placed on the head, it is supposed to awaken that enlightened quality. And then we have red cords, which are called sungdu. And it has a knot, which is called a vajra knot. It's the same as this. It's a knot of indestructibility. So it protects one. And so you can wear it around your neck. If you don't want to wear it around your neck, you can wear it on your wrist. So men is left side and women is right side. And you can wear it for 3 days and then put it on your shrine if you have a shrine. If not, something high. If it's socially inconvenient, you know, to wear it, just don't throw it on the floor. Put it someplace high. And when it gets really old, take it off and you can burn it. And, you know, you don't have to wear it to the bitter end. It doesn't mean you're more devoted. So I leave it up to you. So I'd be happy to perform the blessing. People can, I think this is right.